All right, think about this for a second. You know that feeling. You're about to walk into your first, maybe really intimidating, clinical rotation. Or maybe it's the morning of a huge exam, one that feels like everything hinges on it. And you get that knot in your stomach, right? Your heart's kind of doing a weird fluttery thing, maybe beating way too fast. And your thoughts, they're just racing, jumping from one what if to the next, usually the worst case scenario. That feeling, that apprehension, maybe even a little dread. Well, that's pretty human, it happens. But what happens when that feeling, which can sometimes even be useful, you know, gets overwhelming? When it sticks around day after day and starts to really mess with someone's life? When it stops being just a moment and becomes, well, just constant, suffocating almost. Welcome to the deep dive. This is where we take these big, sometimes complex topics and, well, we try to break them down, make them make sense. And today we are tackling something absolutely vital, especially for anyone going into healthcare and specifically for all of you listening, our future nurses, anxiety disorders. And look, this isn't just something for your psych rotation. No way. This is something you will see, you will need to assess for it, and you will be part of the care team managing it. Doesn't matter if you're in PEDS, critical care, the ER, a clinic. It's everywhere.
That's so true. And for this deep dive, we've really gathered some key resources for you. Think of it as your essential guide. We're pulling from a pretty thorough, comprehensive study guide, you know, covering the basics, and also a concise summary of key points, good for hitting the highlights. Plus, some really practical instructor notes on management. These are great because they connect the dots between the textbook stuff and what you actually do. So think of this session as maybe your shortcut to really getting a handle on this challenge. It's incredibly widespread and can be really debilitating for people.
Yeah, our mission today, really thinking about you, the nursing student, is to equip you, give you that essential knowledge right from the basic definition all the way through to the interventions you'll be using. This stuff isn't just nice to know. It's going to be invaluable every single day in practice. We want to help you clearly see the line, what's normal, everyday anxiety, versus when it crosses over into a disorder. We'll explore the impact, which is often way bigger than you might think. We'll identify the main types of anxiety disorders you're likely to see, and maybe most importantly, give you the tools, the confidence to assess, to care for, and really advocate for your patients who are struggling with anxiety. Hopefully you'll have some of those aha moments today, the kind that really stick with you and shape how you care for people. So let's get started.
Okay, let's unpack this term anxiety. We use it all the time, don't we? Oh, I'm so anxious about this test, or that whole situation gave me anxiety. But what are we really talking about from a clinical standpoint as nurses? Our sources define it as this uncomfortable feeling, apprehension or dread.
It's not just, you know, being sad for a moment or angry. It's this deeper kind of pervasive response. It hits the whole person, body, mind, behavior. And importantly, it's often about anticipating something bad in the future. Could be real, could be imagined. That's a bit different from fear, right? Fear is usually about something happening right now, an immediate danger.
Exactly. And what's absolutely vital for you as a nurse to grasp is where this feeling comes from. It isn't always an obvious external thing like that big exam. It can be triggered by internal stimuli, things happening inside the person, like a specific thought pattern they get stuck in, or a really vivid, maybe upsetting memory, an intrusive image even, or just anticipating something way down the road, but playing it out in their head is a total catastrophe. Or, yeah, of course, it can be triggered by external stimuli too. Certain environments, maybe crowded places, specific social situations, a sudden loud noise, even another person. Understanding these different kinds of triggers, internal and external, that's really step one in your assessment. It helps you see patterns and figure out where to focus interventions.
And it's so, so important to get past the idea that anxiety is just in your head. People might say that, patients might even tell themselves that, but it's not true. It shows up physically in ways that you, as the nurse, are going to be assessing for constantly. Our sources list a whole range of physical symptoms. Think about things like feeling lightheaded or that weird chest pressure that can feel really scary, almost like a heart problem.
Definitely.
Like a racing heart, palpitations, that's the sympathetic nervous system kicking into high gear, dizziness, shaking, sometimes sweating buckets, maybe a dull headache that just won't quit, nausea, trembling, even ringing in the ears, tinnitus. Now, when a patient comes in reporting these things, your assessment skills are critical. Not just to think, oh, maybe anxiety, but first and foremost, always to rule out other serious medical stuff.
Absolutely.
Because, yeah, racing heart and chest pressure could be anxiety, but it could also be an MI. So you always start there, ruling out the most dangerous things.
Always rule out the physical first. Then, beyond those physical signs, You've got the emotional symptoms, that sort of underlying dread that just colors everything. Intense fear, maybe way out of proportion to what's actually happening. And in some cases, yeah, full-blown panic, just sheer terror. But here's where it gets really, really interesting for us as nurses.
Mm-hmm.
And we're understanding this changes everything about how you care for patients, the cognitive symptoms. We're talking about a real, measurable hit to executive functioning.
Okay, executive functioning.
Yeah, this isn't just someone being a bit distracted. This is things like forgetfulness, a really reduced attention span, impaired judgment leading to potentially poor decisions. Even things like impaired depth perception can happen.
Oh, cool.
Language impairment, maybe struggling to find the right words, or difficulty understanding complex instructions,
mm-hmm.
reduced reasoning skills, difficulty planning things out, big challenges with problem solving.
Wow. Impaired executive functioning. That has huge implications for nursing, doesn't it? Right away. I mean, think about patient teaching, discharge instructions. If someone's got these cognitive issues because of severe anxiety, how are they going to remember all that? Especially complex stuff.
Exactly.
Or informed consent. How can someone truly give informed consent for a procedure if their judgment is off? If they can't really weigh the risks and benefits because their reasoning is impaired.
It's a major ethical consideration.
Following a complicated medication schedule or treatment plan, that suddenly becomes incredibly difficult, maybe even dangerous. Knowing this really changes how you have to approach communication and education. It's not just, oh, they might forget. It's literally their brain is working differently under that stress.
Right.
So maybe instead of a detailed handout, you're using super simple language, repeating key points often, using pictures, maybe getting a family member involved if possible.
Yes, involving support systems is key.
And for something like consent, maybe you need to wait. Wait until their anxiety level comes down so they actually can understand and make an informed choice. That's not just adjusting your style. That feels like a core patient safety issue. It requires you to be really observant, really empathetic.
Precisely. It just highlights why our care has to be so individualized, so patient-centered. And then, of course, you have the behavioral symptoms you might see. Things like clear avoidance, avoiding places, people, situations that trigger the anxiety. You might see restlessness, fidgeting, tapping, just unable to sit still. Or agitation, maybe irritability, pacing, just this inability to relax. So you put the physical, the emotional, the cognitive, the behavioral all together, and it paints a much fuller picture of what anxiety really is and how disruptive it can be.
Okay, so we've kind of defined anxiety, looked at all its different facets. Now, why does this matter so much for nurses, just purely in terms of numbers, prevalence?
Well, this is a statistic that always stands out. Our sources are clear. Anxiety disorders are the most common psychiatric illness.
The most common.
The most common. Just let that sink in. Okay. What that means for you is you will see this a lot in almost any setting you work in. It's not some rare thing you might encounter once in a while. It's fundamental. Every nurse needs to understand it.
And thinking about that high prevalence, it means recognizing it, screening for it. It's not just a mental health nurse job. It's everyone's job.
Yeah.
Integrated care.
Absolutely. And the demographics are interesting, too. We know it's more prevalent in women and also in adolescents. For women, you know, you can think about hormonal factors across the lifespan, plus maybe different societal stressors. For adolescents, it's such a time of huge brain changes, figuring out who you are, immense social pressures. It makes sense. Interestingly, the prevalence tends to go down a bit as people get older.
Okay.
So what does that mean for you on the floor? Well, you might approach screening slightly differently. You might be looking for different signs or asking different questions with a teenage girl in urgent care versus an older man in his primary care checkup. It helps you target your care.
And anxiety rarely shows up alone, right? The sources talk about this comorbidity challenge.
Yes, that's a huge factor. It often co-occurs, meaning it happens at the same time as other mental health issues, like depression. That's a very common pairing. Or it happens alongside chronic physical health conditions. Think heart disease, diabetes, respiratory conditions, chronic pain.
So that raises a really important question for practice, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
How does the anxiety mess with the other diagnosis or vice versa?
It's a vicious cycle sometimes.
Does the anxiety make it harder to diagnose the physical thing? Does it make the physical symptoms worse?
Or does having that chronic physical illness just fuel the anxiety? It's definitely a two-way street, and nurses really need to be sharp about spotting this. Take someone just diagnosed with, say, heart disease. They're worried, constantly worried about their health, maybe afraid of another heart attack, dealing with new limitations. That can easily trigger or worsen anxiety.
Makes sense.
Then that anxiety itself, the stress response, can increase their heart rate, raise blood pressure, even cause chest pain. which looks like
more heart problems, making assessment way harder.
Exactly. Or think about a patient with diabetes and GAD, generalized anxiety. The constant worry might make them feel too overwhelmed to keep up with their blood sugar checks, their diet, their meds. Plus, the stress hormones from the anxiety itself, like cortisol, can actually make blood sugar harder to control.
Oh.
And then flip it, just the daily grind, the stress of managing a chronic illness like diabetes,
right,
that can absolutely trigger anxiety in someone who might already be prone to it. So you, as the nurse, need to be looking for this connection because it affects everything: adherence, outcomes, quality of life. You really can't treat the mind and body separately here.
Okay, so it's super common. It shows up in all these different ways. It tangles up with other health issues. So how do we, in practice, draw that line between, you know, my normal exam nerves and something that's actually abnormal, something that needs clinical attention?
Yeah, that distinction is critical for your assessment.
Our sources give some good pointers here.
They do. Let's talk about normal anxiety first. This is really just the tensions of everyday life, as one source puts it. So mild anxiety, like your exam example, feeling a bit keyed up, maybe even helps you focus a little better, that's normal. Or moderate anxiety. This might be about immediate concerns. Maybe you're worried about a friend who's sick, so you call them, you check in. That's appropriate worry prompting action. And then there's what we call normal panic. This is a real appropriate response to an actual immediate threat. Like if there was a fire alarm going off right now, that surge of adrenaline getting you ready to move, that's normal panic. It's adaptive. It helps you survive.
Right. Proportional. Adaptive. Makes sense. So when does it cross that line into abnormal? What are the red flags we're looking for?
It comes down to a few key things, according to our sources. First, the intensity relative to the situation. Is the reaction way, way bigger than the trigger warrants, like a massive panic attack because your train is 5 minutes late?
Okay. Proportionality.
Second, the triggers. Is there a real threat, a genuine danger? Or is this intense anxiety or panic happening seemingly out of the blue with no clear reason? And third, the severity and the pattern of symptoms. Are they persistent? Are they causing significant distress? Are they interfering with a person's ability to function work, school, relationships, basic daily tasks?
And a key example they give.
Yeah, a really clear example of abnormal anxiety is panic attacks that occur without any obvious physical or psychological threat. If someone is just sitting at home watching TV and suddenly they're hit with that overwhelming terror, the physical symptoms, the feeling of losing control or dying,
right,
when there's no actual danger, that's a big red flag. That tells us we're likely dealing with something beyond normal anxiety, something that needs assessment and support. It's that unprovoked nature that's key.
Okay, and understanding not just if someone has anxiety, but the degree of anxiety they're experiencing right now, that seems absolutely essential for how we interact with them as nurses.
Oh, absolutely fundamental. You can't possibly use the same approach with someone mildly anxious as you would with someone in a full panic state. It just won't work.
Our sources lay out the spectrum pretty clearly, right?
Yeah.
And knowing where your patient is on that spectrum dictates everything: communication, education, interventions.
Totally. Let's walk through that spectrum because it's so important for your clinical work. First up, mild anxiety. Again, those tensions of everyday life.
Yeah.
Interestingly, in this state, a person's perceptual field, what they're noticing around them, actually widens a little bit.
Oh, interesting. Widens.
Yeah, they become more alert, maybe more observant. They can see connections between things, notice details, and learning. Absolutely possible. Maybe even enhanced. So this is your prime time for patient education. They can take in complex information. They can ask good questions. They can really engage.
Got it. Mild anxiety, teachable moment. Okay, moving up the scale.
Mm-hmm.
Moderate anxiety. This is described as focusing on immediate concerns. What happens to perception here?
Here, the perceptual field starts to narrow a bit. It's called selective inattention. Their focus really hones in on what's worrying them right now, almost blocking out other things. They might miss stuff happening in the periphery or details in what you're saying, unless you actively point it out to them.
Ah, okay.
They can still focus on other things if you direct their attention, but it takes effort.
So the nursing implication there.
Mm.
If your patient has moderate anxiety, you need to be more direct.
Exactly. You need to actively guide their attention, break information down into smaller pieces, use really clear, simple language, check for understanding frequently.
Repeat things, maybe.
Definitely repeat key points. They can still learn, but you need to be much more deliberate in how you communicate. You're actively helping them focus.
Okay, then it gets more intense. Severe anxiety. The description here is overwhelming feeling that something bad is about to happen. Sounds awful.
It is. At this level, the perceptual field shrinks dramatically. major tunnel vision, mentally speaking. There's also a strong tendency towards dissociation. Feeling detached from their body, from reality, like things aren't quite real, they become almost totally unable to notice anything outside their very narrow, intense focus.
And the really crucial part for us.
Learning becomes impossible. Our sources are very clear on this.
Impossible.
Their brain is just completely overloaded by the internal feeling of terror. There's no bandwidth left to process or retain new information.
Wow. That's huge. So if your patient is in a state of severe anxiety, trying to do discharge teaching or explain a complex diagnosis,
it's pointless. Worse than pointless, actually. It'll likely just increase their distress and frustration.
And yours too, probably.
Probably. Your priority absolutely shifts. It's not about teaching anymore. It's about safety and reducing the anxiety first. You have to help them de-escalate down to at least a moderate level before you can even think about effective education. Pushing information on them when they're like this, bad idea.
Okay, and the top end of the spectrum, panic anxiety. Described as terror, impending doom, a massive threat to survival.
Yeah, this is the most extreme state. The perceptual field is now reduced to maybe just one distorted, exaggerated detail. Our sources talk about massive dissociation. Reality feels warped. Maybe they feel like they're outside their own body. Depersonalization. Or that their surroundings aren't real. Derealization.
And learning.
Still absolutely impossible. Even basic comprehension might be gone. What's really striking here is how profound the cognitive impairment becomes. In a panic state, they can't learn. Their perception is distorted. They might struggle with simple reasoning, problem solving, even understanding simple instructions.
Like you telling them to breathe might not even register.
It might not. Or it might take intense effort and repetition. They're basically in a temporary but very real cognitive and emotional crisis. Primal survival mode has taken over. And knowing this completely changes how you approach emergency care for someone in panic, which we'll definitely get into.
Okay, that foundation is super helpful, understanding the different levels and how much they impact function. Now let's zoom in on the specific diagnoses. The types of anxiety disorders you'll actually see listed in patient charts. First one, maybe the most dramatic, panic disorder, that overwhelming storm you mentioned.
Yeah, panic disorder. It's defined as this extreme, overwhelming form of anxiety. The hallmark is these sudden, distinct episodes, panic attacks of intense fear or discomfort. They usually peak really quickly, within minutes, and they come with a whole bunch of significant physical and cognitive symptoms. It's not just feeling stressed out, it's terrifying. People often feel like they're losing control, going crazy, or even dying.
And we talked about normal versus abnormal panic earlier. Can we just quickly nail that down again, specifically for panic disorder?
Yeah, good idea to reinforce it. Normal panic, real threat, adaptive response. Like the fire example, your body's alarm system is working correctly. Abnormal panic, which is what we see in panic disorder. These intense attacks happen unexpectedly, out of the blue. No obvious danger, no real trigger. The body is screaming danger, but objectively there isn't one. That's the key for the disorder, the recurrent, unexpected nature of the attacks.
So, as a nurse, what's on the diagnostic checklist? What confirms panic disorder?
Okay, so for the diagnosis, you need several things according to the criteria. First, obviously, recurrent, unexpected panic attacks, not just one, and not always tied to a specific stressor. Second, after having attacks, the person develops this persistent concern or worry about having more attacks. They start dreading the next one.
Anticipatory anxiety.
Exactly. Third, they worry a lot about the implications or consequences of the attacks. Like, what if I have one while driving? What if I lose control in public? Am I having a heart attack? Am I dying? And fourth, there are significant changes in behavior because of this fear, usually avoidance. They might stop going places where they've had an attack before or places where they think help might not be available if one happened.
Like avoiding crowds or buses.
Right. And this ties into something often seen with panic disorder, agoraphobia. The criteria mention it can occur with or without agoraphobia.
Yes, agoraphobia. People often just think that means fear of open spaces, but it's more than that, isn't it?
Much more. It's really an intense fear or anxiety about situations where escape might be difficult or embarrassing, or situations where they think help might not be available if they did have a panic attack or other incapacitating symptoms. So yeah, it often leads to avoiding public transport, being in enclosed spaces like theaters, being in open spaces like parking lots, standing in lines, being in crowds, or even just being outside the home alone.
That sounds incredibly restrictive.
It can be terribly debilitating. People can become essentially housebound because the fear of having a panic attack in those situations is so overwhelming.
And who's most at risk? Are there certain groups we should be particularly aware of when screening?
Yes. The risk factors give us some clues. Panic disorder is more common in females. It often emerges in middle age. There's a link with low socioeconomic status and also with being widowed, separated, or divorced. A family history is a big one. If parents or siblings have anxiety disorders or substance abuse issues, the risk goes up.
Genetics playing a role.
Definitely. And childhood separation anxiety is also a notable risk factor, suggesting maybe an earlier vulnerability. Our sources also mention higher rates in white populations. So yeah, knowing these factors helps guide your assessment and screening questions.
Okay, let's get into the why. What's happening biologically? The pathophysiology. It's not just in their head. We establish that.
Right. There's clear evidence of differences in the brain, specifically within what's often called the fear network or the limbic system. Mm. This involves several interconnected structures, like the amygdala that's like the brain's smoke detector, rapidly processing potential threats and triggering the fear response. It seems to be hyperactive in panic disorder.
Okay, overactive alarm.
Pretty much. Then there's the hippocampus, which is crucial for memory. It might play a role in consolidating those fearful memories associated with attacks. The thalamus, which relays sensory info, might misinterpret signals, setting false alarms. And then areas in the midbrain, pons, medulla, cerebellum, these control basic bodily responses like heart rate, breathing. Abnormalities here contribute to the intense physical symptoms. So it's like this whole network involved in detecting and responding to threats is kind of miscalibrated or overly sensitive.
So definite brain differences. And you mentioned genetics.
Yes, strong genetic factors. It clearly runs in families. Studies suggest around 48% heritability.
Wow, nearly half.
Yeah, it's significant. It doesn't mean you'll definitely get it if your parent has it, but your risk is considerably higher. And then there's the HPA axis, the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis.
The stress response system.
Exactly. That whole cascade hypothalamus signals pituitary signals adrenals to release cortisol and adrenaline. In anxiety disorders, this system can become dysregulated. It might be too easily triggered or it might not shut off properly. Basically, the body stays in a state of high alert. So you put it all together, the brain circuitry, the genetics, the stress response system, and you see this complex biological picture underlying panic disorder.
Okay, let's shift to another really common one, generalized anxiety disorder, GAD, often called the chronic worrier. This sounds less like sudden storms and more like constant drizzle.
That's a good analogy. GAD is different from panic disorder. It's characterized more by these chronic, pervasive feelings. Frustration, maybe hopelessness, this ongoing sense of unease or that something bad is looming. Unlike the sudden panic attacks, GAD is this persistent, excessive worry about lots of different things, often everyday life stuff. It's hard to control, and it's there most of the time. That low-grade hum of anxiety you mentioned.
And who gets GAD? What's the epidemiology look like?
Similar to panic disorder, it's about twice as common in women. The onset is usually insidious, meaning it creeps up gradually. People might just say, oh, I've always been a worrier.
Right. They might not even recognize it as a disorder initially.
Exactly. Typical onset is often in childhood or adolescence, frequently showing up by age 20, although it can start later. And because it's so chronic, comorbidity is really common. Often see it alongside depression, other anxiety disorders, or sometimes substance use, perhaps as an attempt to cope with the constant worry.
So how do we diagnose GAD? What separates it from just, you know, normal worrying that everyone does sometimes?
The key is the excessiveness, the duration, the lack of control, and the impairment. For a GAD diagnosis, the criteria specify excessive worry and anxiety happening more days than not for at least 6 months.
6 months, okay. That's a long time.
It is. And the worry has to be about a number of different events or activities, not just focused on one thing. Could it be work, health, finances, family, even minor things like being late? A core feature is that the person finds it very difficult to control the worry. They feel stuck in it. And crucially, the worry or the physical symptoms associated with it cause clinically significant distress or impairment in social life, work, or other important areas. It's getting in the way of their life. That's the line.
Okay, got it. Chronic, pervasive, hard to control, and causes problems. Now, briefly, what about specific phobias? These seem different again?
Yeah, specific phobias are quite distinct. It's an intense, persistent, irrational fear that's focused on a specific object or situation, and it leads to complete avoidance of that thing whenever possible. The fear is way out of proportion to any actual danger, but the person experiences major anxiety, maybe even panic, if they encounter it.
Like fear of spiders or heights or needles?
Exactly. Claustrophobia, fear of enclosed spaces, acrophobia, heights, arachnophobia, spiders, trypanophobia, needles. Those are common examples. The impact on life really depends on how easy it is to avoid the trigger. Fear of snakes might not impact a city dweller much, but fear of flying could be career limiting.
And then there's social phobia or social anxiety disorder. This one seems like it could have really broad effects.
It absolutely does. Social anxiety disorder is a persistent fear of social or performance situations where the person is worried about potential scrutiny, embarrassment, or humiliation. They're afraid of being judged negatively by others, saying something stupid, looking awkward, showing signs of anxiety like blushing or trembling.
And that impacts, well, almost everything involving other people.
Pretty much. Think about how this could affect a patient. Their ability or willingness to seek health care? Terrifying, maybe. Talking to you, the nurse.
Yeah.
Asking questions. Voicing concerns. All incredibly anxiety-provoking. Participating in group therapy for another condition. Forget it, maybe. Even just making appointments can be hard.
So as a nurse, you might see someone who seems really withdrawn, maybe avoids eye contact.
Exactly. And it's crucial not to misinterpret that as rudeness or disinterest. It could very well be driven by intense social anxiety. They're scared of your judgment. Being aware of that really changes how you might approach them, maybe more gently, giving them more time, offering written communication options.
Okay, we've mapped out the territory, the nature of anxiety, the spectrum, the specific disorders. Now let's get really practical. For you, our nurse and students, this is the core, the nursing response, assessment, intervention, care. How do we actually do this? This is where knowledge meets action.
Absolutely. This is where your clinical judgment really comes into play. And the very first step in your nursing assessment, always, 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 is to rule out underlying medical causes. Priority number one.
Medical first, always.
Always. Because so many anxiety symptoms, especially the physical ones like chest pain, palpitations, shortness of breath, dizziness, can mimic serious life-threatening conditions.
Like a heart attack.
Heart attack, pulmonary embolism, thyroid storm, hypoglycemia, even certain drug reactions.
Yeah.
You have to make sure it's not one of those before you zero in on anxiety. That means a good physical exam, getting vital signs, maybe ordering an EKG, blood tests like thyroid function or blood glucose, safety first.
Okay, so critical medical conditions ruled out or managed. What's the next layer of assessment for anxiety itself?
Then you dive into a really thorough symptom evaluation. You need the full picture. So assess the physical symptoms in detail. What are they? When do they happen? What makes them better or worse? How long do they last? Assess psychological symptoms. The feelings of dread, fear, irritability, worry. What are they worried about? Assess cognitive symptoms. Ask about concentration, memory problems, difficulty making decisions. Are they feeling foggy? And assess behavioral symptoms. Are they avoiding things? Are they restless? Agitated. What does that look like? And you need a holistic view, too. Ask about substance use, alcohol, drugs, even caffeine. How's their sleep? Are they getting any physical activity? What's their overall physical health like otherwise? All these things interact with anxiety.
And sometimes just asking isn't enough, or it's hard to gauge severity. We have tools for that, right? Rating scales.
Yes. Using standardized rating scales and questionnaires can be really helpful. They add objectivity. Tools like the GAD-7 for generalized anxiety, or the PHQ-9, which screens for depression but has anxiety questions too. There are scales for panic, for social anxiety. What's great about these is they give you a score, a number. It helps quantify something that feels subjective.
So you can track progress.
Exactly. You can see if the score goes down with treatment. It's great for monitoring effectiveness and for communicating with the rest of the team. Gives everyone a common baseline.
Okay, assessment complete. We have a clearer picture. What are the absolute top nursing priorities when caring for someone actively experiencing anxiety?
The number one priority, the foundation for everything else, is to create a safe, therapeutic environment.
Safe and therapeutic. What does that actually look like?
It means reducing stimuli, maybe dimming bright lights, lowering the noise level, ensuring privacy. It means projecting calmness, yourself, your tone of voice, your body language, being predictable and reliable. It's about creating a space where the patient feels physically secure and psychologically supported so they can begin to feel less threatened and more able to engage.
Makes sense. Build the container first.
Right. Then, medication management is often a key priority. That means administering prescribed meds correctly, but also carefully monitoring their effects. Are they working? Are there side effects? Any adverse reactions? Patient education around meds is huge here too. And then other interventions flow from there, tailored to the patient's anxiety level and specific needs, psychoeducation, coping skills, supportive listening.
Let's zoom in on those high-intensity moments. Emergency care for panic disorder.
the patient is having a full-blown attack right now. What are the critical immediate nursing actions? This is where it gets really hands-on.
Okay, this is crucial, and your actions can make a massive difference in de-escalating terror. First, stay with the patient. Do not leave them alone.
Why is that so vital?
Because in that moment, they feel completely out of control, terrified, maybe like they're dying or going crazy. Your physical presence is an anchor. It communicates safety, support. I'm here. You're not alone in this. Leaving them reinforces their fear of abandonment or losing control completely.
Okay. Stay with them. What's next?
Second, provide reassurance. Use simple, clear, calm statements. You are safe. This is a panic attack. It feels awful, but it will pass. I'm going to stay right here with you.
Oh, not to say.
Avoid things like calm down or just relax. It sounds dismissive and impossible for them to do right then. Stick to factual reassurance and statements of support.
Got it. Stay. Reassure simply. What else?
Third, give clear, concise directions. Remember, their cognition is shot. They can't process complex stuff. Use very short, simple commands. Breathe with me. Demonstrate slow breathing. Look at my hand. Take a small sip of water. Avoid open-ended questions that require thinking.
Keep it basic. Action-oriented.
Exactly. Fourth, if possible, move the patient to a low-stimuli environment. Less noise, fewer people, dimmer lights. Help reduce that sensory overload that's fueling the fire. Fifth, assist them physically if needed. If they're pacing, maybe walk slowly with them. If they seem rooted to the spot, gently guide them to sit down. Match their physical state with empathy. Meet them where they are.
And then medications might come in.
Yes. Sixth, administer PRN anti-anxiety meds as ordered. Usually this will be a fast-acting benzodiazepine if prescribed for panic attacks. Getting that medication on board quickly can help break the physiological cycle.
Timely intervention.
Crucial. And finally, seventh, as the intensity starts to decrease, allow the patient to vent their feelings. Let them talk about the experience without judgment. Validate how scary it was for them. That sounds like it was terrifying. This builds trust and helps them process it.
So it's that balance, right? Calm direction during the peak, then validation and listening as they come down.
Exactly. It's a skillful blend of guidance and empathy.
Okay, so that's the emergency response. What about the longer-term picture, helping patients manage and prevent future episodes? This is where intervention strategies and that psychoeducation piece really shine, and nurses are key teachers here.
Huge role for nurses. Psychoeducation is about empowering patients with knowledge and skills. Giving them a toolkit, we can group these strategies. First, body-focused techniques. Teaching breathing control is fundamental, like diaphragmatic breathing, deep belly breaths. Or maybe square breathing, inhale 4, hold 4, exhale 4, hold 4. You demonstrate it, practice it with them, helps calm the nervous system.
Getting control over the physiology.
Precisely. Another one is progressive muscle relaxation. Teaching them to systematically tense, then release different muscle groups, toes, legs, abs, arms, face, helps them recognize tension and consciously let it go.
And beyond the specific exercises, lifestyle is massive.
Oh, absolutely massive. Educating on nutrition. The link between gut health and mental health is increasingly clear. Reducing caffeine, maybe excess sugar, which can worsen anxiety symptoms. Eating regular meals to stabilize blood sugar.
Simple stuff, but powerful.
Very powerful. And exercise. Regular physical activity is one of the best non-pharmacological treatments for anxiety. Burns off stress hormones, releases endorphins, improves sleep. Even just daily walks help immensely. You help them figure out how to build it into their life.
Okay, then there are the skills focused more on thoughts and behaviors.
Yes, the cognitive and behavioral skills. These are vital for changing patterns. Simple distraction techniques can help in the moment, focusing intently on something else, counting things, engaging the senses. Then there's exposure therapy. Now, this is usually guided by a therapist, but nurses educate patients about it. The idea is gradual, controlled exposure to the feared thing until the anxiety decreases. You explain the rationale, help prepare them, reinforce its value.
Manage expectations, maybe?
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Time management skills can be surprisingly helpful, especially for GAD. Helping patients break down overwhelming tasks, prioritize, schedule things, it reduces that feeling of being constantly swamped and increases a sense of control. Positive self-talk is another big one. Helping patients identify those negative, anxious thoughts, that internal critic, and teaching them to challenge and reframe them. Replacing "I'm going to fail" with "I've prepared, I'll do my best." You coach them on this. And a cornerstone is cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT principles. Again, therapy is often separate, but nurses reinforce CBT concepts constantly. Helping patients understand the link between their thoughts, feelings, and behaviors. How changing negative thought patterns can change how they feel and act. You provide that day-to-day reinforcement. And absolutely essential is trigger identification, helping patients figure out what sets off their anxiety. Keeping a journal, maybe, recognizing patterns. If you know your triggers, you can plan for them or sometimes avoid them.
And inevitably, we have to talk about the role of pharmacologic agents. Medications. Big part of nursing here.
Huge part. Patient education around medications is one of your most critical roles. You need to teach about anxiolytics, maybe antidepressants like SSRIs, which are very common for ongoing anxiety management, especially GAD and social anxiety. Patients need to understand the drug's action, how it works, simply put. The correct dosage and frequency. Potential side effects, what to watch for, when to call the doctor. The importance of not stopping abruptly. You are their go-to source for this info.
Can we look a bit closer at the main types of meds used?
Sure. Broadly, you have short-term anxiolytics. These are mainly the benzodiazepines, lorazepam, alprazolam, diazepam, etc. They work fast, usually by enhancing GABA, a calming neurotransmitter. Great for acute panic or severe anxiety episodes, but they carry risks of sedation, impairment, tolerance, and dependence. So they're typically for short-term or intermittent use. Education on this is critical.
Right. Not usually for the long haul.
Generally not. For longer-term management, SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, like fluoxetine, sertraline, escitalopram, are often first line. They work differently by increasing serotonin levels over time. They take longer to kick in weeks, usually, but they don't have the same dependence risk as benzos and can be very effective for chronic anxiety. With any psych med, though, careful monitoring by the nurse is essential. Watching for therapeutic effects, side effects, any adverse reactions, potential for misuse, managing withdrawal if they're stopped, it's ongoing vigilance.
And we always have to consider risks, especially in mental health nursing. What's the worst case scenario we need to be prepared for with severe anxiety?
It's a somber but necessary consideration. The potential risks are significant. The absolute worst case scenario is a patient harming themselves or others. Unmanaged, severe anxiety can lead to profound hopelessness, despair, feeling trapped. This significantly increases the risk for suicidal ideation and attempts. Always assess for suicide risk. Also, in states of extreme panic or agitation, there's a small but real risk of aggression, often stemming from fear and feeling cornered towards staff, other patients. So this just underscores the nurse's immense responsibility. Comprehensive risk assessment, creating that safe environment, constant observation, knowing de-escalation techniques, having safety plans in place. It's about preventing harm.
Okay, so pulling all these threads together, assessment, environment, meds, therapy principles, safety. What's the overall philosophy for treating anxiety disorders? What's the big picture?
The big picture is that effective management absolutely requires a comprehensive, integrated approach. It's not just one thing. It involves medical interventions like meds, psychological interventions like therapy, coping skills, and supportive interventions like environment, validation, education. And it has to be tailored to the individual. What works for one person might not work for another. So the key components usually include maintaining that calm, quiet environment, especially during acute phases, using anti-anxiety medication appropriately for acute relief when needed, often using maintenance medication like SSRIs for longer-term stability, and a huge emphasis on patient education, teaching them about their condition, about healthy lifestyle choices, about coping strategies, empowering them to be active participants in their own care.
So as a nurse, your role is huge. You're doing all of that.
You really are. You're not just giving pills. You're creating the safe space. You're teaching. You're observing. You're assessing constantly. You're collaborating with the team. You're supporting the patient through it all. You're often the most consistent presence. It's a vital, multifaceted role.
Wow. We have really covered a lot of ground today. We've gone from that initial knot in the stomach through different triggers, the physical and cognitive impacts,
right,
all the way to understanding those different degrees, mild, moderate, severe, panic, and how profoundly they affect someone's ability to function, to learn, to just be. And crucially, we've laid out the nursing priorities, those immediate actions in a crisis, and the longer-term strategies, the education, the interventions that you as future nurses will be using every day.
And I really want to emphasize this for you, our nursing students listening.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't just academic knowledge for a test. No way.
Yeah.
This is practical, foundational stuff that will touch literally every part of your nursing practice. Mm-hmm. You are going to be on the front lines, providing comfort, ensuring safety, implementing effective care for people struggling with anxiety. Your understanding, your empathy, your skills, they can genuinely change the trajectory for these patients. Help them feel seen, supported, and hopeful instead of lost and alone.
So as we wrap up, here's something to think about. A little provocative thought for you to take into your next clinical rotation or even just your next class. Given how incredibly common anxiety disorders are, how often they show up alongside other health problems, how might things change if we adopted a truly proactive, anxiety-informed approach in every area of nursing? Not just psych. Think med-surg, peds, OB, community health, critical care, everywhere. How could that transform patient experiences, patient outcomes? The whole healthcare system, maybe. What one thing from today's deep dive stands out to you the most? How will this knowledge change how you approach your very next patient interaction? Something to really mull over. Thanks for joining us on the deep dive. We hope this has armed you with valuable insights and practical tools for your amazing journey ahead as a nurse.